Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, and this is the 12-Star Apostolic Staff Attorney, Congregation Mountain House of South Island, Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is February 1st, 2018, or it is Shabbat 16, 2021, the third first service today of the song entitled, Give of Your Best to the Master. Give of your best to the Master. Give of the strength of your youth. Show your soul's fresh glory, Lord, into the battle for truth. Now show us the example. Dauntless was he, young and brave. Give him your royal devotion. Give him the best that you have. Give up your best to the Master. Give up the strength of your youth. Fight in salvation for armor. Join in the battle for truth. Give up your best to the Master. Give him first place in your heart. Give him first place in your service. Consecrate every part. Give unto you shall be given. Your beloved Son gave. Gratefully seeking to serve him. Give him the best that you have. Give up your best to the Master. Give up the strength of your youth. Fight in salvation for armor. Join in the battle for truth. Give up your best to the Master. Naught else is worthy his love. He gave himself for your ransom. Gave up his glory above. Lift down his love without murmur, your faults and ruin to save. Give him your heart's adoration, give him the best that you have. Give of your best to the Master. Give up the strength of your youth. Fight in salvation for armor. Join in the battle for truth. Part 3, Final Warning. We're on page 56. Yahweh may smite whereas man cannot. Just as it is impossible for any being aside from Yahweh to injure the heavenly planets, so likewise it is impossible, the symbolism reveals, for anyone to injure the church when she is fully surrendered to Yahweh and consequently under his protection. Thus symbolically he assures his people that he does not allow to come upon them any evil, but that which they themselves invite and which for their good he may permit. Behold, says the psalmist, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. Psalms 121:4. For he that touches you touches the apple of his eye. Zechariah 2:8. But many of Yahweh's servants are thus promised, where these promises are realized. Notably, that there was an instance when the Exodus movement reached the Red Sea and later the River Jordan. and both bodies of the waters rose up upon an heap to afford the people a safe passage and to destroy their enemies. Also, when the three Hebrews were delivered from the fiery furnace, Daniel from the lion's den, Mordecai and his people from the execution instigated by the Haman, and Elijah from the hand of Ahab and Jezebel. Here's this Elijah. Well, we're looking for Elijah once again to be delivered from the antitypical hand of Ahab once again. And the initial first stage of this has already taken place. 2002 at Kermit, Texas, 2003 at Gilead Center. This deliverance of Elijah has already taken place. Indeed, if you have a faith as a grain of the mustard seed, as the Savior declares, you shall say unto this mountain, remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Matthew 17:20. Although the wicked bring the woes, Revelation 8:13, and I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe unto the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. Okay, the last three of the seven trumpets being woe trumpets, unlike the first four, some great change obviously is to take place between the first four and the last three. Having up to this point brought us to the destruction of the first temple and on to the building of the second, the prophetic word of Yahweh leads us on now to the first advent of Yahshua and to his crucifixion. The next great events associated with the trumpets, and these events, ushering in the Old Testament era, or ushering of the Old Testament era out and the new one in, disclose that the last three trumpets embrace the history of the New Testament period. The woes consequently point first to Satan's persecuting the faithful in his endeavor to keep them from embracing Christianity, and second to his persecuting the heathen in his endeavor to Christianize them. The first woe comes with the fifth trumpet. First woe comes with the fifth trumpet. Revelation 9:1-4. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from the heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there rose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the reason of the smoke of the pit, and there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power, and it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of Yahweh in their foreheads. Taking in order the parts, the star, the key, the pit, the smoke, the darkness, and the locust of this fifth trumpet symbolism, we come first to the star. Just as it did the star of the third trumpet, so this fifth trumpet star descended from heaven to the earth. And as the third trumpet star has been conclusively identified as representing the advent of the Bible, then this latter one, since it is similar to the former, must stand for something equivalent of it. The Bible and Yahshua being complementary affinities, each the word of Yahweh, John 1:1-14, then the fact that the descent of the first star is symbolical of the advent of the Bible compels the conclusion that the descent of the second star is symbolical of the first advent of the Yahshua. Moreover, the star is personified as him, masculine, in the gender. Thus, being limited to a male person. And finally, Yahshua himself gives testimony that he is the bright and morning star. Revelation 22:16. To him, he remembered, was given the key of the bottomless pit. And I saw an angel come down from the heaven having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. Revelation 20:1-2. Okay, as Yahshua is the one who secures Satan's captivity, thereby ushering in the millennium, he alone can be fittingly symbolized by the angel having the key of the bottomless pit, and by the star to whom the key was given. And as the giving of a thing to any certain one must precede the having of it by that one, the verbs given, Revelation 9:1, and having, Revelation 20:1, and 1:18, point to two different times. Obviously, therefore, Yahshua received the key at the sounding of the fifth trumpet, sometime before the millennium, hence at the commencement of the millennium, he already has it. Yahshua's submission being to bring deliverance from the prison house of sin and of death, the bottomless pit, and to do so through the preaching of the gospel, or the plan of salvation through his blood. The key, therefore, must be figurative of the gospel, the only power that is able to set free those who are imprisoned in the bottomless pit. So you see, it's through his blood. That's why he has achieved the bottomless pit. He's the only one that can set the captives free, and that's by his blood. Since the bottomless pit of Revelation 20:3 is symbolical of the earth as a prison house during the millennium, then the bottomless pit of the Revelation 9:1, being identical, must likewise be symbolical of the earth as a prison house at another time. This implicitly biblical interpretation of the star, the key, and the bottomless pit reveals that the earth at Yahshua's first advent had become a prison house, a pit for Yahweh's people, and that Yahshua came in order, came to open it in order to save them. For the very fact that Yahweh's people are vested with the power to keep open the bottomless pit, then should they be defeated, the pit would be shut and would become a prison house from which there would be no escape unless it be reopened. And so Satan, in the latter days of the Jews, as the sacred history records, attacked them, took them captive, and thus shut the pit. And knowing that when the Savior should come, he would open it, the dragon therefore stood ready to devour the child as soon as it was born, Revelation 12:4. But losing sight of the infant Yahshua, he incited Herod to slay all the children that were in Bethlehem, and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, Matthew 2:16, in the hope of making rid of the Savior. Under the protection of the providence, however, Yahshua was kept from the bloody hand of Herod. Then, subsequently, with the gospel key, he opened the pit and freed his people. This he himself avowed. For the Spirit of Yahweh, he declared, is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel unto the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of the sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of Yahshua, and Luke 4:18-19, and as a result of the opening of the pit, there came the smoke, the darkness, and the locust. Revelation 9:2, and he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. For the significance of the smoke, we need look no further than to the ceremonial system, which was a compacted prophecy of the gospel And when we say gospel, we're talking about the plan of salvation through the blood of the everlasting covenant. The Acts of the Apostles, page 14. There we behold the ascending smoke of the ceremonial offerings, which, as we know, prefigured Yahshua's great sacrifice in behalf of the human race. Accordingly, the smoke which came from the pit is symbolical of Yahshua's crucifixion, and the darkened sun and the air are symbolical of the darkness over the whole land from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, Mark 15:33, while he was dying on the cross, and the darkness covering the land for the period of these 3 hours shows that at the moment the sixth hour struck, the pit was open. Okay, the sixth hour struck. Well, the sixth hour struck in 1810 with Alexander Campbell, the reformer, the Baptist reformer out of the Catholic Church. You'd have to understand prophecy, the timeline, to understand what I'm saying. This clear sequence of the facts shows that with the gospel key, the good news of salvation through his shed blood, Yahshua, open to his captive people the way of deliverance from the prison house, the bondless pit of sin and death. Thus we see, to recapitulate in brief, that the star is symbolical of Yahshua, the key of the gospel, the pit of the earth, the smoke of his sacrifice, and the darkness of the sun and the air of the darkness that covered the world during his crucifixion. Perfect symbols. Revelation 9:3-4. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of the Yahweh in their foreheads. With the smoke symbolizing the crucifixion and the locust coming out of the smoke, the only admissible conclusion is that they are symbolical of the Christians who came as a consequence of the sacrificial blood that was shed on Calvary, and the fact that they were to hurt only those men which have not the seal of Yahweh on their foreheads makes this conclusion even more inescapable. For only a true Christian, one who has a personal experience of Yahweh, a perfect knowledge of His Word, and who is filled with His Spirit, can discriminate saint from sinner. He only can recognize who has a seal and who does not have it when the latter is cloaked in a counterfeit robe of the righteousness. Okay, the idea that the locusts are symbolical of the Saracen warriors is both unscriptural and illogical, for unlike the locusts, the Saracens killed as many as opposed their way, especially did they trouble the Christians, those who had the seal of Yahweh in their foreheads, and such precisely is Satan's business, that he might kill all who have the seal of Yahweh. Unto those, though, whom the locusts represent the restraining order, was given that they should not kill. Revelation 9:5. Anyone, their business, instead of being to hurt, only those men which have not the seal of Yahweh in their foreheads. Revelation 9:4. For this reason also, the one prior, the locust, cannot symbolize the followers of the Muhammad or of any other of Satan's agents. Had the Christians not been told that they should not kill, they naturally would not have known that they were entering into the period of the grace, and so would have followed the example of the Jewish nation, when as a theocracy charged to execute Yahweh's judgment, they were commanded to kill and to drive out of the land, as was revealed by the first three trumpets. Both those who were departed from him and those who did not acknowledge him as the only true Yahweh. As the only true Yahweh. His command, however, to the locusts, that they should not kill, inaugurates a significant change in his people's dealing with his enemies. The great principle of the non-resistance enjoined in this chain. Yeshua enunciated in his Sermon on the Mount, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also." Matthew 5:38-39. Preaching Yeshua and him crucified was a bitter cup to quaff for those who, because they loved sin and despised reproof, hated him and his people. The Christians consequently became a great nuisance and vexation to their antagonists. Indeed, just as the Old and the New Testament scriptures, the two witnesses, which are the two olive trees, two prophets, Revelation 11:3-10, were so great a torment unto the wicked during the 40 and 2 months, Revelation 11:2, just so the locusts became so great a torment by the preaching of the gospel that both the Jews and the Romans persecuted and killed as many of them as time allowed, thus fulfilling the first woe. Just think how many were converted on the day of the Pentecost alone, about 3,000 souls. And following that, the Yeshua added to the church data such as should be saved. Acts 2:41-47. This sudden great increase in the numbers among the Christians after the crucifixion made them appear to be swarming like locusts. Then, too, a locust can never be frightened nor made to defend themselves under any provocation. Neither is there felt in the human heart any sorrow or pity for them, be they ever so ruthlessly killed. Yet they cannot be exterminated by the human hand. For these reasons, they are a perfect symbol of the early Christians' indomitable courage and meekness in the face of the cruel oppression of them by their heartless enemies and of the impossibility of the letters bringing about an extinction of the Christianity. Revelation 9:7. First clause. And the shape of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle. Horses are prepared for battle by being well trained, a fact which in this connection manifestly denotes that the early Christians swiftly and proficiently marched on with their message as horses in the battle array. Revelation 9:7. Second clause. And on their heads were, as it were, crowns like gold. So obvious as to require no interpretation, the locusts having crowns of gold signifies their being invested with the authority pure and excellent, the authority of the Yeshua. And such was exclusively the investment of the members of the early Christian church. Yeshua secured it unto them in his commitment. I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Matthew 16:19. Revelation 9:7, third clause. And their faces were as the faces of men. Observe that the locusts have human faces, symbolizing intelligence, but mark especially that they are masculine. Were they feminine, the symbol would be faulty. For the face of a woman does not naturally characterize a soldier. Revelation 9:8, first clause. And they had hair as the hair of a woman. A woman's hair being her glory, 1 Corinthians 11:15. And a woman being symbolical of the church, Jeremiah 6:2. The feminine hair shows that the locusts were affiliated with the church and that she was their glory. So that we ourselves, says Paul, glory in you and the churches of Yahweh for your patience and faith in all your persecutions and tribulations that you endure. 2 Thessalonians 1:4. Revelation 9:8, second clause, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. Though a lion is the most fearsome of beasts, yet had he no teeth, he would be scarcely more fearsome than a dog. The locust having the teeth of lions denotes that the early Christians had far greater potential power to defend themselves and to kill every beast, man, that was not of their kind, a Christian, than had ancient Israel against the heathen in their day. For this reason, it was necessary to command the locusts not to kill. A demonstration of the power which they possessed is seen in the fate of the Ananias and Sapphira, who instantly upon Peter's exposing their sin of the dissimulation, fell dead at the apostles' feet, Acts 5:1-11. Clearly then, if Peter without exertion on his part had sufficient power to destroy hypocrites who came into his presence, he most certainly had as much power to destroy the heathen who attempted to retard the advancement of the gospel, Revelation 9:9, first clause, and they had breastplates as it were breastplates of iron. For the scriptural significance of the breastplate is faith and love. 1 Thessalonians 5:8, the Christian's only defense and the locust breastplate were as it were breastplates of iron, the strongest metal known. The faith, therefore, of those fearless soldiers of the cross was so invincible, and their love for Yeshua and for his people so pure and unconquerable, that daily in the temple and in every house they ceased not to teach and preach Yeshua Messiah, Acts 5:42. Though for so doing they were killed like locusts. Oh, what a contrast between these heroic love slaves of Yeshua and most professed Christians of the day. Revelation 9:9, second clause. And the sound of their wings was as the sound of the chariots of many horses running to battle. As has been seen so far, the symbols of the fifth trumpet show that though the early disciples were mercilessly persecuted and killed, yet they openly and fearlessly swarmed to the battle line to proclaim the gospel of Yeshua, and in giving an individual sample of their fearless efforts, Paul said, I kept back nothing that was profitable unto you, but have showed you and have taught you publicly and from house to house, testifying both to the Jews and also to the Greeks, not knowing the things that shall befall me. Acts 20:20-22. How many of the day's disciples of Yeshua would knowingly risk their lives for the proclamation of the gospel, even in the time of peace? Most Christians would rather send a missionary to do the work which the Yeshua calls to be done than to go do it themselves. And thus, serving by substitute, by proxy, as it were, they are not unlike the cuckoo who lays her eggs in other birds' nests for them to hatch and to care for. And some, because of their ignorance of Yahshua's majesty and of his power to protect, because of their blindness to their duty and to the recompense of the reward, are even ashamed openly to confess him in word and in deed. Revelation 9:10 will be explained after Revelation 9:11. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath he his name Apollyon. Genuine Christians as subjects of the kingdom of Yeshua have over them Yeshua, their king, ruling over them in the Old Testament time, 1 Corinthians 10:1-4, as well as in the New Testament time. He is therefore king over them in both periods. Consequently, the Old Testament scriptures being originally written in the Hebrew tongue give him the name Abaddon, whereas the New Testament scriptures, being originally written in the Greek, give him the name Apollyon. In the blazing light of this symbol, intensifying the illumination from the whole series of the kings of which it is a part, and which no human mind could either have devised or thus rightly interpreted, Yeshua is clearly seen to be the king of his people, in both the Old and the New Testament period, an author of the Scriptures in both the Hebrew and the Greek. And from this fact it follows that as he is the Word, the Bible in the human form, his Hebrew name of Abaddon is also the name of the Old Testament Scriptures, and his Greek name Apollyon is also the name of the New Testament Scriptures, showing that he recognizes his sovereignty over the church not only in the New Testament period, but also in the Old Testament period. Paul, in his epistle to the Christians, declared, "Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank to that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Yahshua." 1 Corinthians 10:1-4. Woe to him who accepts the one testament and casts aside the other, pays no attention to either, or exalts tradition above both. Abaddon, Yahshua's name in the Hebrew, signifying him as a destroyer, shows that in the Old Testament period he simply destroyed many of his enemies, whereas Apollyon, his name in the Greek, signifying him as an exterminator, shows that in the New Testament period he will exterminate all the wicked. What beautiful precision of connotation in these symbolic appellations, and this extraterminatory work is vividly pictured in the climatic scene. And out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of the Almighty Yahweh, and he hath on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Sovereign of Sovereigns. And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying unto all the fowls that fly in the midst of the heaven, "Come and gather yourselves together unto the supper of the great Yahweh, that ye may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of captains, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and of them that sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free and bond, both small and great." Revelation 19:15-18. "Unto those, therefore, who accept Yeshua as their king, he is a savior. While unto those who refuse to have him rule over them," Luke 19:14, "he is a destroyer. Hence, accordingly, the curses or judgments fall, as the trumpets reveal, upon those who reject the teaching and the authority of the Bible, and who, as a result, do not have the seal. These solemn facts greatly admonish us not to forget the Bible's warning that our treatment of it will bring one of two results, death or life. Revelation 9:10, first clause, "And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails." We have seen that the locusts are symbolical of the soldiers of the cross. We know that the tail of an animal is the hinder member of its body. In other words, it's rear guard. So we have no choice but to conclude that the tails of the locusts symbolize the church's regarding its followers. Furthermore, the tails being a connected part of the body shows that both the ministry and the laity of the early Christian church was bound together inseparably in the Yahshua, Romans 12:5, and contributing to another. So reads the record, "For as many as were professors of the lands or houses sold them and bought the prices of the things that were sold and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man according unto as he had need." Acts 4:34-35. Revelation 9:10, as second clause, "And there were stings in their tails." Their tails representing their converts, and at the same time having stings in them, then obviously in the rapid accession of the disciples to the religion of Yahshua, there was a sting, a torment to the wicked. "What shall we," they cried in consequent despair, "do to these men, for that indeed a notable miracle hath been done by them in the manifest to all them that dwell in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny. But that it spread no further among the people, let us straightly threaten them, that they speak henceforth no more to no man in this name. And they called them and commanded them not to speak at all or teach in the name of Yahshua, for the world is gone after him. Acts 4:16-18. John 12:19. Revelation 9:5-6, and to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months, and in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. Seeing that the locusts are symbolical of the followers of the Yahshua after the crucifixion, and that they were commanded not to resist their enemies, the 5 months therefore began at that time, and seeing furthermore that death does not as yet flee any man, but still reigns over all, the 5 months are in consequent figurative time and extend from the crucifixion to a time when death shall flee from some men, that is, to the time when some will be made invulnerable to death. Revelation 9:10, third clause. And their power was to hurt men 5 months. The fact, too, that the trumpets are figurative is another evidence that these 5 months are figurative time. But why should this period in which the locusts, the Christians, have power to torment men, be limited to 5 months? It will be noted that the 144,000 are called the first fruits, denoting that they are sealed at the beginning of the harvest, for the commencement of the time to separate the tares from the wheat, to the parable of the harvest. Then we must go for the full explanation of the 5 months period. In tract number 3, the harvest, the time from the baptism of Yahshua to the close of probation, is shown to be illustrated by 12 figurative months. 6 from Yahshua's baptism to his crucifixion. 5 from the crucifixion to the ingathering of the first fruit. 144,000, Revelation 14:4. Leaving 1 month for the ingathering of the second fruits, the great multitude, Revelation 7:9. During the 5 figurative months, the locusts were commanded to torment those who had not the seal of Yahweh, but not to kill them. This command implies that after the expiration of this period, the killing restriction will cease, and that from then on, the wicked will be killed rather than tormented only. At that time, the four angels of Revelation 9:15 will have prepared themselves for to slay the third part of man. These several linked facts present a solid change of the evidence that in the Christian era, during the 5 figurative months, Yahweh has deferred his vengeance to grace. And hence it follows inescapably that such Christians as executed the death penalty upon those who disagreed with them were working against Yahshua rather than for him. For as Christians locusts, they were commanded not to kill, but to bless even those who despitefully used them. Indeed, to him who would smite them on the one cheek, they were to turn the other cheek, and if he should take away their cloak, they were to let them have their coat also. Luke 6:28-29. After the expiration of the 5 figurative months of the restriction during which they were not to kill, some will be made vulnerable to death for the finishing of the gospel work, and will, if necessary, to the discharging of the responsibility, be glad to die, but cannot. Revelation 9:6. And in those days shall men seek death, and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. The experience of Yahshua's first disciples will explain why that after the expiration of the 5 months, men will desire to die, but cannot. Despite the great persecution against the faithful of the primitive Christian church, their vision of the world's great need urged them on to preach the gospel of Yahshua at the cost of their lives. And notwithstanding cruelest death awaiting them, they, in faith, encouraging Yahweh, held the light of the gospel before the people as constantly as the sun holds its rays over the earth. I came into Asia, testifies the death-bound apostle, after what manner I have been with you at all seasons, serving the Yeshua with all humility of mind and with many tears and temptations which befell me by the lying weight of the Jews. And now, behold, I know that ye all, among whom I have gone preaching the kingdom of Yahweh, shall see my face no more. Wherefore I take you to record this day, that I am pure from the blood of all men, for I have not shunned to declare unto you all the counsel of Yahweh. And when we heard these things, both we and they of that place besought him not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, what mean ye to keep to weep and to break mine heart? For I am ready not to be bound only, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of Yeshua Messiah. Acts 20:18-19, 25:27, 21:12-13. By preaching in the name of Yeshua, the Christians in Paul's time were indeed seeking death, esteeming it their greatest privilege and honor to die for him. They desired to do so if others might by their death obtain eternal life. Though Elohim's people today shall go through a time of trouble such as never was, Daniel 12:1, when earthly tribunals shall cause to come to pass that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed, Revelation 13:15, yet the word declares, at that time thy people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book, Daniel 12:1. Oh, what a promise and what assurance! Who can comprehend Yahweh's mighty power and the glory of this long-awaited deliverance? Those who at all do and who fully trust in Yahshua will, for the good of his people, go forth therefore unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach. Hebrews 13:13. And thus pursuing a course against all earthly favor by the proclaiming of the message of the full hour, they will be going forth as sheep in the midst of wolves, Matthew 10:16, seeking death, and although happy to die for the Yahshua's sake, or as Revelator puts it, though they shall desire to die, the promise is that death shall flee from them, making it impossible for them to die. Even the sword of the wicked that is raised to kill them shall break and fall as powerless as a straw, making them utterly invincible. In that day, saith Yahshua, whosoever shall seek to save his life shall lose it, and whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it. Luke 17:31-33. In short, only those who desire to die for Yahshua's sake shall obtain eternal life. One woe, fifth trumpet is passed, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. Revelation 9:12. The next being in the sixth trumpet, Revelation 9:13-11-14. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before the Yahweh, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And coming from the golden altar, the command, loose the four angels, shows that the sixth trumpet sounded sometime during the veil, sometime before the veil to the most holy apartment of the heavenly sanctuary was lifted. Otherwise, the voice would have come from the throne, the most holy place. For detailed treatment of the lifting of the veil, see tract number 3, the harvest. But as has been shown, we are still in the period of the fifth trumpet, a fact which invokes the question, how then could the sixth trumpet have sounded before the events of the fifth had expired? It will be observed that though each of the trumpets began at a definite time, yet one overlaps the other, and all seven extend to the second coming of Yahshua. This is seen in the coexistence of the truths of all seven. The flood, fifth trumpet. The Exodus movement, second trumpet. the giving of the Old Testament scriptures, third trumpet. The church going into captivity, the fourth trumpet. Yeshua's first advent and subsequent events, the fifth trumpet. All are sounding louder today than ever before. And as these truths constitute the gospel for today, it is evident that though the trumpets run in consecutive order, each begin at a different time, they all continue enforced until the end of the world, terminating therewith. Thus the rejection of one being tantamount to the rejection of all seven. The lesson is sharply drawn that the object, that to reject one truth is to reject the whole truth. With the 14th verse of Revelation 9 begins the description of the sixth trumpet, and it ends with the 14th verse of Revelation 11, which announces the second woe, second trumpet, is past, and behold, the third woe cometh quickly. Accordingly, each prophetic event recorded between Revelation 9:14 and 11:14 must find its fulfillment in the period of the sixth trumpet between the first and the second woes. In the light of this fact, we see that the time in which the two witnesses of Revelation 11:3 were to prophesy 1,260 days clothed in the sackcloth must occur during the sound of the sixth trumpet, and being in the future tense, the phrase shall prophesy 1,260 days, Revelation 11:3, shows that at the time the trumpet begins sounding, this period of 1,260 days was yet future. For the voice which came from the golden altar said unto the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. In order to identify the four angels, we must first understand the literal meaning of the river Euphrates. The capital city of ancient Babylon was built on either side of the Euphrates, thus dividing the city in two parts. The river was also the source of the water supplying a fortified moat about the city. So because the ancient Babylonians were the first to build on the banks of the Euphrates, and because the original application must attach to the original settlers there, the great river Euphrates emerged as the top of the waters where the whore sitteth, Revelation 17:15, modern Babylon. And this important truth is amplified by the fact that the ancient city Babylon does not now exist. Whereas prophecy calls for a Babylon today, there must necessarily be. Now, in order for there to be a modern Babylon, there must necessarily be a repetition today of the conditions and events essentially characterizing ancient Babylon in its connection with the Yahweh's people. Consequently, their captivity in the Babylon, the type, Jeremiah 29:10, must find its parallel in the Babylon, the Antitype. Very obviously, therefore, the angels being bound in the great river Euphrates must be figurative of the Christian church during the period of her captivity in the antitypical Babylon, that great city, rising after John's time. Furthermore, the statement made by the voice from the golden altar, loose the four angels which are bound, conclusively shows that when the voice spoke to the church, the angels were already in captivity and was to be loosed. Revelation 9:15, first clause. And the four angels were loosed. For the execution of the command, loose the four angels, meaning to set the church free from her captivity in Babylon, resulted in her being liberated from her long bondage to the tyranny of the church-state rule, and in the Bible being restored to Yahweh's people, so that they might study and worship in fear and in favor of no man and in accountability only to their conscience and to their Elohim. And the consequent dissolution of the church-state union, the four angels were loosed. Revelation 9:15, last part, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay the third part of men. For the fulfillment of the Josiah Litch's prediction calculating an hour and a day and a month and a year of the Revelation 9:15 to total 391 years and 15 days, reckoning a day for a year, as in Ezekiel 4:6, is the strongest semblance of the truth to be found in the Uriah Smith's interpretation of the trumpet. little wonder, then, that its advocates are doing their best to keep the people believing in it by the stoutly maintaining that the great controversy lends support unto the position established by the religious prediction. And the year of 1840 reads this record and mention another remarkable fulfillment of the prophecy excited widespread interest. 2 years before, Josiah Lynch, one of the leading ministers preaching of the Second Advent, published an exposition of Revelation 9, predicting the fall of the Ottoman Empire. According to his calculations, this power was to be overthrown in A.D. 1840, sometime in the month of August. At the very time specified, Turkey, through her ambassadors, accepted the protection of the Allied powers of Europe, and thus placed herself under the control of the Christian nation. The event exactly fulfilled the prediction, the Great Controversy 334. To say that the Great Controversy says is perfectly permissible, to say what the Great Controversy says is perfectly permissible, but to say that it is supporting the idea that Josiah Lynch's interpretation of the hour, day, month, and year biblically denotes a period of 391 years, 15 days, ending in 1840, A.D. is not permissible. Moreover, the event which took place in 1840 did not fulfill the biblical prediction, for the very simple reason that at the end of the hour and day and month and year, the four angels were to slay the third part of men. In actual fact, though, at the date which Lysias' prediction was fulfilled, no slaying took place, and Turkey, instead of being overthrown, was without bloodshed, placed under protection of the European nation. Furthermore, the four angels, and not a nation, for a nation is never symbolized by angels, were to be made free, and then they were to kill the third part of men. Whereas the Turks killed none, but instead of being made free, they were really placed under mandate. Still further, John heard that the number of them who were to do the slaying was exactly 200 million cavalrymen, horsemen. But Turkey never had that many cavalrymen in all their lifetime. Having already seen that the fire, smoke, and brimstone stone are symbolical, not literal, and that hence they do not come forth as a volley from a firearm in the hand of a Turk, we are in consequence led to probe further for their significance. And then so we find that Revelation 9:20 reveals that the symbolical fire, smoke, and brimstone result in plagues, not firearms, but plagues, therefore are the means with which the horsemen slay the third part of men. Since the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk, Revelation 9:20. The object in the slaying a third part of the men is manifested not to accomplish some selfish end, but rather to help men repent. Resuming with the religious prediction, it is plain to see that the Great Controversy is not attempting in what it says concerning the prediction to explain the subject of the trumpet. It is merely recording an historical event. Therefore, its statement, in the year of 1840, another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy excited widespread interest, must not be construed as advocating Josiah Lynch's interpretation of the Revelator's prophecy, but instead recording the fulfillment of his prediction based on the revelation. Thus it was the letters, not the Bibles, or the Great Controversy position that exactly fulfilled the prediction. But one may ask, if Revelation 9:15, upon which Josiah Lynch's prediction of the date in question was built up, did not meet its fulfillment at the time he pointed to, then what made the Turks on the very day set accept the Christian nation as a protectorate? Did Satan cunningly bring the Turks to terms on the date predicted by Litz in order to forestall and discredit this wonderful truth of the trumpets and thereby to firmly entrench his deceptions in the church? As to that, we do not know, but this we do know, that despite the fact that Litz unintentionally misapplied the scriptures, yet on the very day which he predicted for the fall of the Ottoman Empire, some power brought the empire under the protection of the allied powers of Europe. Thus, though, it is certain that on the set date, something happened to Turkey. It is even more certain that this happening was not in the fulfillment of the biblical prophecy. Let it suffice, however, that Yahshua turned Lysias' prediction into a blessing. When it became known, multitudes were convinced of the correctness of the principles of the prophetic interpretation of the 2300 days adopted by Miller and his associates, and a wonderful impetus was given to the Advent movement. Men of learning and position united with Miller both in preaching and publishing his views, and from 1840 to 1844, the work rapidly extended, the Great Controversy 335. Okay, this brings the close of our study this hour. Contact us at the 11th hour call. We're going to close now with a song. Breath in the Soul by Elijah David. Song that I've written February 26, 2006. I used to like the things that tempted me, just like the world started with tea. A little okay, it's a sample, it's part of food. Just like sinning, that's what it is. Started out with a little kiss and ended up with bills long overdue. After I thought I'd had enough of sampling all that wonderful stuff, I went to the yard and threw in the towel. He asked me what changed my mind. A little too much of that red wine, and besides that, too little clean wet to fly. For the word of Yah is breath in the soul, something that I'll never let go, something that means more than tongue can tell. Rising up early, going to bed late in the quiet hours, and let it fade, and then I fall asleep, for all is well. I used to like the things that appealed to me, just like others I couldn't see. Couldn't say to Yah's word to save my soul. Then one day I opened his book, that I've longed for so, something that had never will grow old. The end that I stood as I began to read, I soon discovered I had a great need to be baptized in the likeness of his death. I long for the day to be like him, to be free from sin and hold again. I close my eyes and see red. Being born of the Spirit and washed in the blood, a question gets y'all like nothing else does. Fills ye with his love now and eternally. So take hold, brother, and don't you let go. I wrap his love all around your soul, putting it on display for all the world to see. The bird of Yah is breath in the soul, something that I'll never let go, something that needs more than tongue can tell. Rising up early, going to bed late in the quiet hours, and every day, and I fall asleep for all is well, and then I fall.